Wait. I put my finger in my other ear. I didn't want to mishear this. Go ahead. It's 126 Bald Street. It's in the old part of Crystal City by the river, between the Pentagon and Washington National. Got that? Yeah. I let it sink into my head. I'd been to the Pentagon before and had used the domestic airport a couple of times. I had a rough memory of the area. Are you going to phone me tomorrow? Yeah. Same time. Same time. Stay lucky, mate. Cheers. And that was it. I turned off the power and repeated the address to myself to keep it in my head. I wasn't going to write it down. If I got lifted, I needed to be sterile. On the way back to the hotel, I was feeling quite upbeat. Up until now, I'd been in the wilderness. I didn't exactly know what I was going to do with this new information. But it was a start. I felt more in the driving seat. We ate, and I watched some telly with her, but she seemed more interested in talking.
Do you watch television at home, Nick?
Some.
What's your favorite program?
I don't know. The news, I suppose. We have different programs from you. What's your favorite?
Clueless.
What's that? A detective?
Loser. Moron. Double moron. It's about a girl.
She did a very good impression of a valley girl. What does she do?
She goes shopping.
By 10:45, she'd fallen asleep. I got out the city guide I'd forgotten to give back at the Latham Hotel and looked for Bald Street. I followed the river south until I saw Washington National Airport. The target was between that and the Pentagon, on the West Bank. I had a little laugh to myself. If it was a pyro location, they had a lot of bollocks. They probably drank at the same bars as the boys from the National Security Council. There was not a lot I could do at the moment. Kelly was lying on her back, imitating a starfish. I covered her with the eiderdown, moved all the shit off the other bed and got my head down. A saying from my infantry days a lifetime ago roared in my ears. Whenever there is a lull in battle, sleep. You never know when you are going to get another chance. At last, I was doing as I'd been told. When I woke up, it seemed like the same cartoon was running. I must have left the TV on all night. I was gagging for a brew. I got up, wet my hair, made myself look semi-presentable, and looked out of the window. The rain had got a bit more intense. I went downstairs and collected enough food and drink for three people, which was just as well, seeing the amount that Kelly ate. Wakey, wakey, I said. Kelly still wanted to be marine life, but she woke up, yawning, stretching, then curling up into a ball. I went into the bathroom and started to run a bath. She appeared in the doorway with a towel. She was starting to catch on. While she was splashing around, I sat on the bed flicking through the news channels. There was nothing about us. There had been so many other murders in the homicide capital of the USA that we were old hat. She came out, got dressed and combed her hair, all without a single reminder from me. I opened an eat-from-the-pack carton of cereal for her and poured in some milk, then headed for the shower. When I reappeared, all clean and presentable, I said, "We've got to move from here today." Her face lit up.
"Can we go home now? You said Pat was going to help us go home."
I picked her coat off the hanger and helped her put her shoes on. "Really soon, yes, we will. But Daddy needs more time to rest. Pat's will find out when it's okay," I said. "But first, we've got to do stuff. It's really difficult for me to explain to you what's going on just now, Kelly. But it won't be long. I promise you will be home soon."
"Good, because Jenny and Ricky are missing me."
My heart missed a beat. Had I fucked up? Had there been other people in the house? She must have read my mind.
They're my teddies.
She laughed, then her face went serious.
I miss them. And I want to go to Melissa's party.
I started patting the top of her head. She looked at me. She knew she was being patronized. I changed the subject. Look, I'll show you where we're going. I got out the map. This is where we are now, and that's where we're heading, just by the river. We'll get a taxi, find a nice hotel, and we'll make sure they've got cable, so we can watch films. If they haven't, maybe we could go see a movie.
Can we see Jungle to Jungle?
Sure we can. What the fuck was that? Never mind. At least we'd got off the subject of family. After checking out and, to my surprise, being offered a one-night rebate, I went upstairs to collect Kelly and the blue nylon sports bag. I left the USP in the cistern. It only had one magazine of 9mm, and I was carrying 3 of 45 with the SIG. Leaving the hotel, we turned left and immediately left again. I wanted to get out of line of sight of reception before somebody thought of asking, "Where's the wife?" We hailed a cab, and I asked for Pentagon City. The driver was an Asian in his 60s. He had a map on his seat, but didn't bother to look at it. We seemed to be heading in the right direction. Kelly had her hat on. I thought of teasing her that she looked like Paddington Bear, but it would have taken too long to explain. The driver asked where exactly I wanted to be dropped. "The metro stop, please." I didn't have a clue where that was, but it sounded as good a place as any. I paid the old boy his cash, and off he drove. The whole area looked new and high rent, both shopping and residential. There was a Ritz-Carlton hotel, and a few minutes away, the Pentagon. I got my bearings and led Kelly towards the mall. I wanted to visit an ATM to celebrate the start of a new financial day. We exited and walked across the supermarket car park, then on towards the river. It was strange because, for the first time, I felt like I was really responsible for her. I still held her hand when we were crossing roads, but now it seemed natural to keep holding it on the sidewalks too. I had to admit, it felt good to have her with me. But maybe that was only because I knew it looked natural and therefore provided ideal cover. We walked under the concrete freeway bridge that led to downtown DC. It was very busy, and the movement of traffic sounded like muffled thunder. I told Kelly about the scene in Cabaret where Sally Bowles goes under the railway bridge to scream when things get too much for her. I didn't tell her that was what I'd been feeling like doing for the past 48 hours. Once past the bridge, the landscape changed. It was easy to imagine what this area must have looked like maybe 50 or 60 years earlier, because it hadn't been fully developed yet. It was full of derelict railway siding buildings, some of which had been taken over as offices, though much of the area was just fenced off into lots or used as car pounds. I looked left and saw the elevated section of the highway disappear into the distance towards downtown DC. A concrete wall hid all the supports, and a road ran alongside. There was no sidewalk, just a thin strip of hard ground littered with drinks cans and cigarette packets. It looked as if people parked up on the verges here to avoid the parking charges further in. There were old, broken-down buildings everywhere, but the place was still being used. On the right was a fringe theatre in what had once been a railway warehouse. The tracks were still there, but they were now rusty and weeds were growing through. From above us came the continuous roar of traffic on the elevated highway. We passed a scrap metal merchant's, then a disused cement distribution plant, where the boats used to come up the Potomac and dump their loads. I then saw something that was so totally out of place it was almost surreal. A late 1960s hotel, the Calypso, was still standing in defiance of progress. It was marooned in the middle of an ocean of chrome, smoked glass and shiny brick, as if the owners had decided to lift a finger to the property developers who were slowly taking over this dying area. It was a very basic four-story building, built in the shape of an open square. In the middle was a car park crammed with cars and pickups. There were no windows on the outer walls, just air conditioners sticking out of the breeze block. I turned left, with the highway thundering away above me. I walked past the hotel on my right-hand side. I was now parallel with Ball Street, which lay behind it. Kelly hadn't said a word. I was in work mode anyway. And if it weren't for the fact that I had hold of her hand, I would probably have forgotten she was with me. As we got level with the Calypso, I wiped the drizzle from my face and peered up into the gloom. On its roof was a massive satellite dish, easily 3 meters across. It wouldn't have looked out of place on top of the Pentagon. We turned right and right again. We were on Ball Street. From street numbers on the map, I knew that the target was going to be on my left. I kept to the right side for a better perspective. It was still incredibly noisy. If it wasn't an aircraft taking off from the airport just the other side of the tree line, it was the continuous roar from Highway 1.
"Where are we going?"
Kelly had to shout to be heard above it all.
"Down there," I nodded. "I want to see if we can find a friend's office. And then we can find a nice new hotel to stay in."
"Why do we have to change hotels all the time?"
I was stumped on that one. I was still looking at the street numbers, not at her.
"Because I get bored easily, especially if the food's no good. That one last night was crap, wasn't it?"
There was a pause, then,
"What's crap?"
"It means that it's not very nice."
"It was all right."
"It was dirty. Let's go to a decent hotel. That's what I want to do."
"But we can stay at my house."
A jet had just left the runway and was banking hard at what appeared to be rooftop level. We watched for a while, transfixed. Even Kelly was impressed. As the roar of its engines died down, I said,
"Come on, let's find that office."
I kept looking forward and left, trying to judge which building it was going to be. There was a hodgepodge of styles. Old factories and storage units. New, purpose-built two-story office blocks rubbed shoulders with car parks and truck container dumps. In between the buildings, I could just glimpse the trees that lined the Potomac, maybe 300 meters beyond. We were in the high 90s, so I knew the Pyra office block wouldn't be far away. We walked on until we got to a new-looking two-story office block, all steel frames and exposed pipework. All the fluorescent lights were on inside. I tried to read the nameplates, but couldn't make them out in the gloom without squinting hard or going closer, neither of which I wanted to do. One said Unicom, but I couldn't make out the others. It didn't look much like the sort of Sinn Féin or Pyra offices I was used to. Cable Street, in Londonderry, for example, was a two-up, two-down in a 1920s terrace. And the places in West Belfast were much the same. They certainly weren't high-tech office blocks that looked like miniatures of the Pompidou Centre. Had Pat got this right? In my mind, I'd been expecting some old tenement. Chances were this was just a front. It would be a commercial business, and the people working there would be legit. I focused on the target as we completed a walk past, but didn't look back. You have to take in all the information first time around.
"Nick?"
"What?"
"I'm wet."
I looked down. Her feet were soaked. I'd been concentrating so much on what to do next that I hadn't noticed the puddles we were walking through. I should have bought her a pair of wellies at the mall. We got to a T-junction. Looking left, I could see that the road led down towards the river. More cars parked up on verges, and even more scrapyards. I looked right. At the end of the street was the elevated highway, and, just before that, above the rooftops, I could see the dish on top of the Calypso Hotel. I was feeling good. A target walk past and somewhere to stay. and all before 11 a.m.
Chapter 16.
We walked into the hotel car park. I pointed between a pickup truck and a UPS van. Wait under the landing. Keep out of the rain, I'll be back soon.
I want to come with you, Nick.
I started my puppy training act. No. Wait. There. I won't be long. I disappeared before she could argue.
The hotel reception was just one of the ground floor rooms turned into an office, and checking in was as casual as the layout. The poor Brit family story was understood a lot quicker here. They obviously didn't grow too much corn around these parts. I went outside, collected Kelly, and as we walked along the concrete and breeze block towards our new room on the second floor, I was busy thinking about what I'd have to do next. She suddenly tugged my hand.
Double crap.
What?
You know, not nice. You said the other one was crap. This is double crap.
I had to agree. I even thought I could smell vomit.
No, no, wait till you get in. You see that satellite dish? We can probably get every single program in the world on that. It's not going to be crap at all.
There were two king-sized beds in the room, a big TV and the usual dark, lacquered surfaces and a few bits of furniture. A long sideboard that had seen better days. A wardrobe that was just a rail inside an open cupboard in the corner, and one of those things that you can rest your suitcase on. I checked the bathroom and saw a little bottle of shampoo.
See that? I said. Always the sign of a good hotel. I think we're in the Ritz.
I plugged in the telephone and recharger, then it was straight on with the telly, flicking through the channels for a kids' program. It was part of the SOPs now. I pulled her coat off, gave it a shake-out and hung it up. Then went over to the air conditioner and pressed a few buttons. I held my coat out, testing the airflow. I wanted the room to get hot. Still waiting for some reaction from the machine, I said, "What's on?"
"Power Rangers."
"Who are they?" I knew very well what it was all about. But there was no harm in a bit of conversation. I didn't want us to be best mates, go on holidays together and share toothbrushes and all that sort of shit. Far from it, the sooner this was sorted out, the better. But for the relationship to look normal, it had to be normal. And I didn't want to get lifted because some busybody thought we didn't belong together. I said, "Which one do you like?"
"I like Catherine. She's the pink one."
"Why is that? Because of the color?"
"Because she's not a geek. She's really cool."
Then she told me all about Catherine and how she was a Brit.
"I like that because Daddy comes from England."
I made her change into a pair of jeans and a sweatshirt. It took a lifetime. I thought, fuck parenting, it's not for me. Every moment of your time is taken up. What was the point if you just spent all day on butler duty? She was finally dry and sorted out. Next to the TV was a coffee percolator and packets of milk and sugar, and I got that on the go. As the machine started to purr and bubble, I went to the window. As I looked out of the net curtain, left and right of me were the other two sides of the drab, grey concrete square. Below was the car park, and across the road and higher up was the highway. I realised that my mood matched the view. Rain was still falling. I could see the plumes of spray behind the trucks as they rolled along the highway. It wasn't heavy, but continuous, the kind that seeps into everything. I was suddenly aware of Kelly standing next to me. "I hate this type of weather," I said. "Always have. Ever since I was a teenager and joined the army. Even now, on a really wet and windy winter's day, I'll make myself a mug of tea and sit on a chair by the window and just look out and think of all the poor soldiers sitting in a hole in the middle of nowhere, freezing, soaking wet, wondering what they're doing there." A wry smile came to my face as the percolator stopped bubbling and I looked down at Kelly. What wouldn't I give to be back on Salisbury Plain, just sitting in a soaking wet trench,
My only worry in the world, how to stop being wet, cold and hungry. I went and lay on the bed, working out my options. Not that there were that many. Why didn't I just make a run for it? I could steal passports and try my luck at an airport. But the chances of getting away with it was slim. There were less conventional routes back. I'd heard that you could get all the way from Canada to the UK by ferry and land hopping, a route popular with students. Or I could go south, getting into Belize or Guatemala. I'd spent years in the jungle on that border, and I knew how to get out. I could go to an island off Belize called San Pedro, a staging post for drug runners on their way to the east coast of Florida. From there, I could get further into the Caribbean, where I'd pick up passage on a boat. More bizarre still, one of the blokes in the regiment had flown a single-engine Cessna from Canada to the UK. The tiny fixed-wing aircraft had no special equipment apart from an extra fuel bladder in the back. The radio wasn't the right kind, and he had to work out the antenna lengths with wire hanging from the aircraft on a brick. He wore a parachute, so that if anything went wrong, he'd open the door and leap out. How I'd sort that out, I didn't know, but at least I knew it could be done. However, there was too much risk involved in all of these schemes. I didn't want to spend the rest of my days in a state penitentiary. But at the same time, I didn't want Kelly and me to be killed in the process of escaping. Simmons had presented me with the best option. If I turned up in London with what he wanted, I wouldn't exactly be home and dry, but at least I'd be home. I had to stay and tough it out. It all boiled down to the fact that I needed to see who and what was going into and out of the building on Ball Street. Kelly, you know what I'm going to say, don't you? Without a doubt, she smiled. I'd obviously been forgiven for drying her hair and putting her into nice dry clothes. 10 minutes, all right. I closed the door, listened, heard her put it on the latch and hung the sign on the door. Further to my left was a small open area that housed the Coke and snack machines. I bought a can, then walked back past our room towards the lift. To the left was the fire escape, a concrete staircase leading up and down. I knew the safety regulations meant that there had to be an exit onto the roof. In the event of a fire down below, the rescue would be by helicopter. I went upstairs as far as I could. Double fire doors led to the roof, pushed the bar and they'd open. There was no sign warning that the doors were alarmed, but I had to check. I looked around the doorframe but couldn't see a circuit break alarm. I pushed the bar and the door opened. No bells. The roof was flat, its surface covered with 2-inch diameter lumps of gravel. I picked up a handful and used it to jam the doors open. An aircraft was landing at Washington National, and I could just see its lights through the drizzle. The satellite dish was on the far corner of the roof. There was also a green aluminium shed, which I guessed was the lift housing. A meter-high wall ran around the edge of the roof, hiding me from the ground but not from the highway. I walked across the gravel to the side facing the river. Looking down at the target building from this angle, I could see the flat roof and its air ducts. It was rectangular and looked quite large. Behind it was an area of waste ground and fences that seemed to divide the area into new building plots waiting to be sold. I could just make out the Potomac beyond the tree line at the end of the runway. I walked back, stepping over a series of thick electricity cables. I stopped at the lift housing. What I wanted now was a power source. I could use batteries to power the surveillance equipment I'd be using, but I couldn't guarantee their life. I tried the door of the lift housing, but it was locked. I had a quick look at the lock. A pin tumbler. I'd be able to defeat that easily. Back in the room, I got out the yellow pages and looked for addresses of pawn shops. Then I went into the bathroom, sat on the edge of the bath and unloaded the .45 ammunition from the magazines into my pocket, easing the springs. It's not something that you have to do every day, but it needs to be done. The majority of weapon stoppages are magazine-connected. I didn't know how long it had been left loaded. I might squeeze off the first round, and the second one wouldn't feed into the chamber because the magazine spring had stuck. That's why a revolver is sometimes far better. Especially if you're going to have a pistol lying about for ages and don't want to service it. A revolver is just a cylinder with 6 rounds in it. So you could keep it loaded all year and it wouldn't matter. As soon as you pick it up, you know the thing will work. I emptied the magazines into my pocket so that I then had the ammunition, magazines and pistol all on me. I came out of the bathroom and wrote myself a shopping list of kit that I was going to be needing, and checked how much money I had. There was enough for today. I could always get more out tomorrow. I wasn't worried about Kelly. She had loads of food and was half asleep anyway. I turned up the temperature dial even higher on the air conditioner. She'd soon be drowsy. I said, "I'm going to go and get you some colouring books and pencils, and all that sort of stuff. Shall I bring back a Mickey D's?" "Can I have sweet and sour sauce with the fries? Can I come with you?" "The weather's terrible. I don't want you catching cold." She got up and walked to the door, ready to drop the latch without me having to ask. I went downstairs and walked to the metro station. Chapter 17. The Washington Metro is fast and quiet, clean and efficient, everything an underground should be. The tunnels are vast and dimly lit, somehow soothing, which is maybe why passengers seem more relaxed than in London or New York, and some even exchange eye contact. It's also about the only part of the capital where you won't be asked by a 17 or 77-year-old Vietnam vet if you can spare some change. I got out after 7 or 8 stops and 1 platform change. The place I was looking for was just a few blocks away. But it was in a neighborhood I bet didn't feature in anybody's holiday brochure. I was used to the Washington where those who had really had. This was the part of town where those who didn't have had absolutely fuck all. The single-story building was set back from the road and looked more like a supermarket than a pawn shop, with frontage that was at least 50 meters long. The whole facade was glass, with bars running vertically. The window displays were piled high with everything from drum kits to surfboards and bedding. Fluorescent yellow posters promised everything from 0% interest to the best gold price in town. 3 armed guards controlled the doors and watched me enter. Looking along one of the aisles to the rear, I saw a long glass showcase that also formed the counter. Behind it were more than a dozen assistants, all wearing a similar red polo shirt. It seemed to be the busiest department in the shop. Then I saw all the handguns and rifles behind the glass. A sign announced that customers were welcome to test fire any weapon on the range out back. I carried on towards the camera department. In an ideal world, what I was looking for would be something like a security camera, with a long lead connecting the camera itself to a separate control box that also housed the videotape. I could put the camera in position on the roof, leave it where it was, and hide the control box elsewhere. Maybe inside the lift housing. That way it would be easier for me to get to it to change the tape, and, if I couldn't find mains power, the batteries, and all without having to disturb the camera. Unfortunately, I couldn't find anything like that. But I did find something that was almost as good, and that was a high-8 video camera, the type favoured by a lot of freelance TV journalists. Certainly, I'd be able to change the lens to give me more distance. I remembered working in Bosnia and seeing guys running around with high-8s glued to their eyes. They all thought they were destined for fortunes by selling the network's bang-bang footage. I caught the eye of one of the assistants. "How much for the high-8? I said in my usual bad American accent. "It's nearly new, hardly out of the packaging. $500. I smirked. "So make me an offer," he said.
Has it got a spare battery and all the attachments for external power?
Of course. It's got it all. It's even got its own bag.
Can I see it working?
Of course. Of course.
All right. 400, cash. He did what every plumber and builder throughout the world does when discussing prices. Started sucking air through his teeth.
I'll tell you what. 450.
Done. I also want a playback machine. But it mustn't be a VCR.
I have exactly what you want. Follow me.
The machine he retrieved from the back of a shelf had a $100 price tag. It looked about 100 years old, complete with dust. He said,
I'll tell you why. Save the trouble. $90 and it's yours.
I nodded. I also want some lenses.
What sort are you after?
At least a 200mm to go on this, preferably Nikon. I worked on the basis of 1mm of lens for every meter of distance to target. For years, I'd been stuck in people's roof spaces after breaking into their houses and removing one of the tiles so I could take pictures of a target. And I'd learned the hard way that it's wasted effort unless the result is good, ideable images. He showed me a 250mm lens.
How much? $150.
He was waiting for me to say it was too much. All right, done. If you throw in 2 4-hour tapes and an extension lead. He seemed almost upset at the lack of fight.
What length?
More haggling. He was gagging for it.
The longest one you've got. 20 foot?
Done. He was happy now. He no doubt had a 40 foot. I came across a Walmart a couple of blocks short of the metro. I ducked inside and wandered around looking for the items I'd need to help me set up the camera. As I moved down the aisles, I found myself doing something I always did, no matter where in the world I was. Looking at cooking ingredients and cans of domestic cleaner, and working out which would go with what to make chaos. Mix this stuff and that stuff, then boil it up and stir in a bit of this, and I'd have an incendiary device. Or boil all that down and scrape off the scum from round the edge of the pot, then add some of this stuff from the baker cake counter and boil that up some more until I've just got a sediment at the bottom. And I'd have low explosive. 20 minutes in Sainsbury's would be enough to buy all the ingredients for a bomb powerful enough to blow a car in half. And you'd still have change from a tenner. I didn't need any of that today, however. What I was after was a 2-litre plastic bottle of Coke, a pair of scissors, a roll of bin liners, a mini maglite torch with a range of filters, a roll of gaffer tape, and a selection pack of screwdrivers and pliers. 21 pieces for $5, and an absolute rip-off. They'd last about 5 minutes. But that was all I'd need. That done, I grabbed a book of adventure stories for Kelly, some colouring books, pencils and other bits and pieces to keep her entertained. I also put a few more dollars in Mr. Oreo's pocket. I entered the metro and found a bench. Lights at the edge of the platform flash when a train's approaching. Until then, most locals sit chatting or reading. There was nothing else to do, so I opened the Coke, had a biscuit, started a dot-to-dot picture in one of the colouring books, and waited for the lights. The rain had stopped at Pentagon City, though it was still overcast and the ground was wet. I decided to do a quick walk past the target while I didn't have Kelly. Cutting across the supermarket car park, I headed for the highway tunnel and Ball Street. I was soon on the same side of the road and level with the building. A small concrete staircase surrounded by dense shrubbery led up to the glass doors at the front. They opened into a reception area and then another set of doors that probably led into the office complex itself. A security camera was trained on the front doors. The windows were sealed, double glazed units.
Inside, the building on both floors seemed full of PCs and notice boards, the normal office environment. I couldn't see any external alarm signs, nor any signs saying that the property was guarded. Maybe the alarm was at the rear. If not, whatever detectors existed were probably connected to a telephone line linked directly to the police or a security firm. I got to the end of the road, turned right, and headed back to the hotel. The room was like a sauna. Kelly's hair was sticking up all over the place, and she had sleep in her eyes. Her face was creased and had some crumbs stuck on it. By the looks of things, she'd been halfway through a biscuit and fallen asleep. As I dumped all the kit on the side, she said, "Where have you been?" "I bought loads of stuff." I started diving into the bags and dragging things out. "I've got you some books, some colouring books, some crayons." I laid them on the bed and stepped back, waiting for some form of appreciation. Instead, she looked at me as if I was some sort of madman.
"I've done those."
I hadn't known. I thought a colouring book was a colouring book. I'd quite enjoyed doing my dot to dot. "Never mind. I've got you some sandwiches and some Coke. And you're to drink as much as you can because I need the bottle for something."
"Aren't we going out for something to eat?"
"There's some biscuits in there." I pointed into the bag.
"I don't want any more cookies. I hate it in here all the time."
"We've got to stay in the hotel today. Remember, we've got people who are looking for us at the moment, and I don't want them to find us. It won't be for long." I suddenly thought, shit, what if she knows her home number and starts using the phone? While she was pouring out some Coke, with both hands around the bottle that seemed as big as she was, I stretched around the back of the small cupboard between the two beds and pulled out the telephone jack. I looked at my watch. It was 4:30. The best part of 5 hours to go until Pat made contact again. I wanted to get the camera sorted out. I wanted it working at first light. I might even be able to get in an hour of filming before last light today. Kelly got up and looked out of the window, a bored, caged-up kid. I poured myself some Coke and said, "Do you want some more of this before I tip it away? I need the bottle." She shook her head. I went into the bathroom and tipped the remainder down the sink. I ripped the wrapper off and, with the scissors I'd just bought, I made a cut at the top where the bottle started to curve into the neck. I also cut at the base, so I was left with a cylinder. I cut a straight line up it and pushed the resulting rectangle of plastic down flat to get rid of the curve. I cut a circle, by first trimming off the corners of the rectangle, then developing the shape. That was me, ready to burgle. I came back into the room and checked the leads and made the camera ready for use, by battery or mains.
"What are you doing, Nick?"
I'd been hoping she wasn't going to ask, but I should have known better by now. I had a lie all prepared. "I'm going to make a film so you can say hello to Mummy, Daddy and Aida, because you said you were bored. Here, say hello." I got the camera to my eye.
"Hello, Mummy, Daddy and Aida," she said into the camera. "We are in a hotel room, waiting to come home. I hope you get well soon, Daddy."
"Tell them about your new clothes," I said.
"Oh, yes."
She walked over to the wall.
"This is my new blue coat. Nick got me a pink one also. He knows my favorite colors are pink and blue."
"I'm running out of tape, Kelly. Say goodbye." She waved.
"Bye, Mommy. Bye, Daddy. Bye, Aida. I love you."
She came skipping over to me.
"Can I see it now?"
Another lie. "I haven't got the leads to plug in the TV, but I'm seeing Pat soon. Maybe he'll get some for me." She went back to her glass of Coke, a very happy bunny. She picked up a crayon, opened the colouring book, and was soon engrossed. Good. It meant I was able to put a tape into the camera without her seeing. I picked up 2 plastic coffee cups, got the rest of the kit together, put it all in the video bag and said, "Sorry about this, but..." She looked at me and shrugged. I made my way up to the roof. The rain was holding off. The aircraft and traffic noise wasn't. The first thing I wanted to do was get into the lift housing. I needed to know whether or not I could get mains power. I got out my circle of plastic and put it in a crease of the green door. I pushed and turned it, making it work its way through the twists and turns of the door frame until it hit against the lock itself. The door was there to keep people out for safety reasons, not to protect something of value. So it was a simple lock to defeat. Once inside, I turned on my mini maglite torch, and the first thing I saw was a bank of 4 power points. I looked up at the ceiling. The shed was made up of panels of 1/4-inch mild steel bolted onto a frame. I got the pliers and undid 2 of the bolts, just enough to lift up a bit of the roof. Then I got the power lead from the camera, pushed it through the gap and ran it down against the wall. It didn't look out of place amongst all the other shit. I plugged the lead into one of the power points. I kept the door open to give me some light while I prepared the camera. I got 2 bin liners and put 1 inside the other, then put the camera inside, pushing it against the plastic at the bottom until the lens just burst through. I then took the 2 plastic coffee cups, split them both down the sides, cut the bottoms off both, put them into one another, and fed them over the lens as a hood. That was going to keep off the rain, but at the same time let enough light into the lens so the thing could work. I used gaffer tape to keep everything in position. I got on the roof with the camera and plugged it in. I lay flat and looked through the viewfinder, waiting for it to spark up and show me what the lens could see. I wanted a reasonable close-up of the staircase leading up to the main door. Once it had jumped into life, I focused the lens, got it bang on target, and pressed play. I tested stop and rewind, then play again. It worked. I tucked in the plastic, making sure not to dislodge the camera, pressed record, and walked away. Chapter 18. I went and bought a dustbin-sized pizza, which we sat down and ate in front of the television, with the telephone plugged in and on charge. Then it was just a matter of hanging around with indigestion, waiting for Pat to call and the 4-hour tape to finish. It was dark now, but I wanted it to run the full 4 hours. 1, to check that the system worked, and 2, to see what the quality was like at night. Both of us were bored. Kelly had endured death by TV, death by pizza, death by Mountain Dew and Coke. She wearily picked up the adventure book and said, "Can you read me some of this?" I thought, "All right. It's just a collection of stories. It won't take that long to read a couple." I soon discovered it was 1 continuous adventure, with optional endings to each chapter. I was reading to her about 3 kids in a museum. 1 had gone missing, no one knew where, when the story just stopped. At the bottom of the page it said, "Do you want to go to page 16 and follow him through the magic tunnel? Or do you want to go and see Madame Edie on page 56, who might tell you where he is? It's your choice." "Where do you want to go?" I said. "Through the tunnel." Off we went. After about 3/4 of an hour, and changing tack about 8 times, I thought we must be getting to the end soon. It took nearly 2 hours to get through it. At least she had fun. The room was warm and I still had all my kit on, ready to go. I kept dozing off, waking up every 30 minutes or so to the sound of The Simpsons or Looney Tunes. One time I woke up and looked down at my jacket. It had come undone and my pistol was exposed. I looked across at Kelly, but she didn't even give it a second glance. Maybe she was used to her dad wearing one. I opened up a can of Mountain Dew and looked at my watch. It was only 8:15. I'd go and get the first video in about a quarter of an hour's time, put in a new tape, and then wait for Pat's call. When the time came, I said, "I'm just popping out for 5 minutes to get some drink. Do you want some?" She looked quizzical and said, "We've got loads here." "Yeah, but they're warm. I'll bring some cold ones." I went up to the roof. It was damp and drizzling now. I opened up the back of the plastic bag, pressed the eject button, and quickly exchanged tapes ready for the morning. I came downstairs, past our room, and got another couple of cans of drink. Coca-Cola shares had probably rocketed over the last few days. Clueless came on, the TV series she told me she loved. I was amazed as I listened to her reciting all the catchphrases off Pat. "Loser, double loser, moron, whatever." Now I knew where a lot of her sayings came from. At last, it was just 3 minutes to go before Pat was due to check in. I went into the bathroom, closed the door, and listened for Clueless. Nothing. Dead on time, the phone rang. "Hello?
All right, mate. Thanks for the sub."
We both had a quiet laugh. "Do you know what floor they're occupying?" There was a short pause, then...
"Second floor."
"Okay. Any chance of more money? I need a big wad, mate."
"I could get you about 10 grand, but not until tomorrow, or possibly the day after. You're welcome to it until you're sorted. And I take it you've got a way out?"
"Yeah," I lied. It was for the best. If he got lifted, he could only give false information, and they'd start looking at airports and docks instead of mincing around Washington. Then I said, "I need more contact in case I manage to find out anything about the building, and things start changing rapidly. What about 1,200, 1,800, and 2,300? Is that okay?"
"All right, mate. Your little friend and her family have been in the media a lot lately. Is there anything else?"
"No, mate. Be careful."
"And you. See ya."
I turned off the telephone, went back into the bedroom and put it back on the charger. I didn't know if Kelly had heard anything or not, but she was quiet and seemed uneasy. I got the video player set up, pushed in the tape, and tuned in the television. Kelly was watching intently. "Do you fancy playing a game?" I said. "If not, I'll just do it on my own."
"Okay."
It beat counting cars on the highway.
"But you said you didn't have any leads to put into the TV."
She'd got me on that one.
"I bought some when I went out." "So why can't we see the video for my mommy?"
"Because I've already posted it. Sorry." She looked at me a little confused. "We're going to watch this tape of a building," I went on. "It's got people going in and out of it. Now, there's going to be some famous people going in there, and people that you know, like friends of daddy's and mummy's, and people that I know. We've got to see how many people we can each recognize. Whoever sees the most is the winner. You want to play?"
"Yeah."
"You've got to be really quick because I'm going to fast forward it. Every time you see somebody moving, you've got to tell me. Then I'll stop and rewind and we'll have a look at it." I took some of the hotel stationery and a pencil and off we went. I had to use the button on the machine to fast forward because there was no remote. I sat on the floor under the player by the TV. Kelly's eyes didn't leave the screen. I was quite pleased with the tape. The quality wasn't bad at all. You could tell the difference between this and a home video. And I'd managed to get full-length pictures of the people covering about two-thirds of the screen.
"Stop! Stop! Stop!" she shrieked.
I rewound and had a look. Kelly had made me stop at the first hint of movement. There were a few people entering. I didn't recognize any of them. Kelly was sure that man number three was from a pop group called Backstreet Boys. She got into the game more and more. Everyone seemed to be famous. I logged them all using the counter. 298. Two men, one with a long light coat, one with a blue coat. People think that being a baby spy is all James Bond. Sports cars and casinos. I'd always wished the fuck it was. The reality is sheer hard graft to get information, then sitting down and working out what it is you've gathered. The fact that two people walk up a set of stairs means fuck all. It's interpreting what's going on that's important. Identifying them, their body language, what happened before, what you think is going to happen later on. So you have to log everything, just in case at a later date it might be important. Give me a sports car any day. The screen was slowly getting darker. The ambient streetlight was helping, but it was quite hard to see faces and we were losing colour. I could tell the difference between a man and a woman and their ages, but only just. It came to the end of the working day and everything began to close down. People going home were throwing switches and the light dwindled. In the end, there were lights only in the hallway, reception area and corridors. I left the tape running at normal speed. What I now wanted to know was whether there was a night watchman around, but I couldn't see anyone. Kelly was loving it. She'd seen four actors, two of the Spice Girls and one of her school teachers. Not bad at all. But what if she did recognize somebody? I couldn't be entirely sure of what she said. I'd have to take it with a pinch of salt. After all, she was only seven. But I'd have nothing to lose by believing her. Do you want to do this again tomorrow?
Yes, I like it. I have more points than you.
So you do. I'll tell you what, after all that winning, I think you should lie down on the bed and have a rest. If Kelly or I recognized anybody on the tape tomorrow, it would be a bonus for me to take to Simmons and prove a link. It would also mean that I'd definitely have to CTR the building and find out why they were there. I decided to go and have a closer look at the outside, and then I could plan how to make entry. By 11 p.m, Kelly was sound asleep. Still fully clothed. I put the eiderdown over her, picked up the key card and left. To avoid the office, I came out of the hotel via the emergency stairs. I got on the road by the highway, turned right and walked past the playhouse towards the Target. The traffic was quieter now, just groups of noise instead of a constant roar. I turned right, then right again. I was on Ball Street. Chapter 19. It was the back I really needed to take a look at. But first I wanted to recce the front again. I wanted to see if there was a night watchman in there and get a better mental picture of what it looked like inside. I moved into a doorway opposite. If I was pinged, I'd pretend I was drunk and having a piss. I was in deep shadow as I looked over at the Target. I could see through the two sets of doors into the reception area. The lights were still on, giving a sheen to the wet concrete steps and the leaves of the bushes. I looked upstairs and saw light shining through the windows directly above the main entrance. That meant the corridor lights were on upstairs as well. I waited around for a quarter of an hour, watching for signs of movement. Was there security sitting downstairs watching the telly? Was he upstairs doing his rounds? I didn't see anything. Time to look at the rear. I went back the way I'd come, but instead of turning left, went right towards the river. It was just a single-track road with muddy slush on the sides and potholes filled with oily water that glistened in the ambient light. Using the shadows, I passed the scrap metal merchants and crossed over the railway tracks that led to the old cement depot. My footsteps made more noise than the highway now. Fences divided all the plots, secured with old chains and padlocks. I followed the road further, looking for a point to turn and get behind the Target. The highway lights weren't strong enough to have any effect at this distance, but I could make out the mist coming from the river. I'd reached a dead end. A fence blocked the old road and a large, muddy turning circle had been made by cars looking for a parking space and discovering what I just had. I could also see lights from the airport, beyond the woods that sloped down to the Potomac. There was no alternative but to walk back to the disused railway tracks, which, years ago, would have been a branch of the main line. I looked left. Following the tracks, they ran about 200 meters to the rear of the target, and to their left were some old, rusted, corrugated iron buildings. I started climbing over the wire gates, where the trains would have gone through to the depot. The padlocked chains rattled under the strain. I got into some shadow and waited. There were no dogs barking, and the airport was probably closed down this late at night because it was so close to the city. All I could hear was a distant siren. I carried on along the tracks, and soon the only noises were of my feet and breath. To my right was the scrapyard, enclosed by a fence with old cars piled on top of each other 7 or 8 high. After about 100 meters, the ground started to open up, and I could see buildings. Fences made it clear what belonged to whom. The area had been cleared and flattened, ready for developers. One of those buildings beyond it was the rear of my target. On the other side, I could see streetlights on Bull Street and the highway. The drizzle gave them a misty, faded look. I slowed down, had a quick look at the target, then started to walk across the 150 meters of newly leveled ground to a fence that was about 50 meters short of the target building. Near the fence, I found some bushes, stopped and squatted down. The things that always give you away are shape, shine, shadow, silhouette, spacing and movement. Forget about them, and they'll get you killed. Still on my haunches, I did nothing but sit and watch for the next few minutes. You have to give your senses a chance to adjust to a new environment. After a while, my eyes began to adapt to the light, and I could start to make things out. I could see that there were no windows in the back of the building, just a solid brick wall. There was, however, a 4-flight steel staircase. The fire escape route for both the ground and first floors. To the right of it, at ground level, were the junction boxes for the building's utilities. I looked at the fire exits. If I had to make entry at some stage to find out what Pyra were up to, that was probably the way I'd go in. It depended whether or not they had external locks, and there was only one way to find out. I scanned along the line of the 6-foot chain-link fence, looking for a break. I couldn't see one. Grabbing the top edge of the wire, I pulled myself up, got a foot on the top and clambered over. I crouched down again and stayed still, watching and listening for any reaction. There was no need to rush. Slow movement meant that not only did I reduce noise and the risk of being detected, but I could also control my breath and hear more around me. I used the shadows created by the building and trees, moving from one pool of darkness to the next, all the time keeping eyes on the target and the surrounding area. Once I got close enough, I stopped at the base of 2 trees and stood against one of the trunks. Looking at the rear wall, I noticed a motion detector that had been fixed at a height and angle to cover people walking up the fire escape. I had no way of knowing what the detector triggered, whether it was an alarm, a light, or a camera, or maybe all 3. I couldn't see any cameras, but I could see 2 light fittings, 1 above each fire exit. They weren't on. Were they what the motion detector triggered? Probably. But why wasn't there also a camera covering the rear, so that security could see what had triggered the light? It didn't matter. I'd treat the detector as if it triggered everything. I noticed 3 wooden pallets to the right of the building by the fence. I could use those. I looked at the doors. They had sheet steel covering them, together with an extra strip that went over the frame to prevent anyone tampering with the gap. Close up, I could see that the locks were pin-tumbler type, similar to British Yale's, but bigger. Piece of piss. I could defeat them. A quick check of the utilities boxes and dials showed me that gas, electricity, water and telephone were all exposed and ready to be played with. I was feeling better about this all the time. I was still worried about the possibility of a night watchman. In some circumstances, it can actually be a bonus. You can try to get him to come and open the door. And, hey presto, you've got an unalarmed entry. However, if I had to go in, it would be covertly. The car park was empty, which could be another indication that there was no one inside. I had to confirm it one way or another. I decided to be slightly pissed, walk up to the main entrance and take a leak. While I was doing that, I could get a better look inside. If there was anyone in the foyer, he might come out and fuck me off. Or I might see him watching telly in the back somewhere. I followed the same route all the way back and walked onto Ball Street. I was quite damp now. The drizzle and wet, rusty fences had done their work on my clothes. I walked on the opposite side of the road toward the target. As I got nearer, I started to cross at an angle that gave me more time with eyes on. Head down, conscious of the camera covering the door, I started to stumble up the steps, and about 3/4 of the way up, as soon as I was able to see into the right-hand window, I turned, opened my flies and started pissing down onto the bushes. Almost instantly, a male voice roared, "Fuck you! Fuck you! Fuck you!" And there was an explosion of movement in the shrubbery. I nearly jumped out of my skin. I took my hand straight off my cock and onto the cig. I tried to stop pissing, but I was in full flow. My jeans took the brunt. I went for the pistol, then realized that maybe I didn't need to pull it yet. He might be security. Maybe I could talk my way out of this.
"Fuck you! Who do you think you are? You fucker!"
I could hear him, but still couldn't see anything. There was rustling and all sorts going on. Then more, "Fuck you! Fuck you!" And I saw him appearing through the bushes.
"Fucking asshole! Piss on me, you fuck! I'll show you! Look at me! You've pissed on me!"
He was in his early 20s, wearing old army boots without laces and dirty, greasy black jeans. He had a hooded parka-type jacket that was in shit state, grimed with muck and with the elbows hanging out. When he was about 10 meters away, I could also see he had a bum-fluff beard, a big earring in one ear and long, greasy dreadlocks. He was soaked. The moment he saw me, his face lit up. To him, I was the accidental tourist, Mr. Hushpuppy lost at the wrong end of town. I could almost see the cogs turning. He thought he'd cracked it here. He was going to get some easy money out of this punter.
"Fuck you, asshole. You owe me a new sleeping bag. Look at my clothes, you've pissed all over me. Fucking animal. Give me some money, man."
He was certainly going for an Oscar.
"Do you know who I am? Fucking piss on me, man. I'll fucking kick your ass."
I needed to take advantage of this. I went up to the window and started banging hard. If there was security, he should come to investigate. I'd just play Hushpuppy Man needing protection from this madman. I banged so hard I thought the glass would break, making sure all the time that I had my back to the camera. It sparked up New Age Man even more because he thought I was flapping. He started to come up the stairs. I carried on looking inside the building. There were no used ashtrays in sight, no magazines lying open on chairs. No TV on, no evening paper. The furniture was well arranged. The chair by reception was neatly under the desk. There was nothing to show that anyone was there. Nearly on top of me now, I heard,
"Fucking asshole!"
I turned, opened my jacket and put my hand on the pistol. He saw it and stopped in his tracks.
"Ah, for fuck's sake! Fucking hell!"
He backed off and started to walk backwards down the stairs, his eyes fixed on the pistol.
"Fucking cops," he muttered.
I had to try hard not to laugh.
"Fucking cops, piss on me every fucking which way."
I waited for him to disappear. New Age Man thought he had problems. This was the second time in 2 days that I'd had piss all over me. All the same, I felt sorry for him. I thought about all the time he'd probably spent finding himself a snug little basher, well concealed from predators and nicely warmed by the air conditioning outlets and other machinery tucked underneath. Then some dickhead comes and empties his bladder all over the show. It took me 1/4 of an hour to get back to the hotel. I opened the door nice and quietly. Kelly was in child heaven, not having had to clean herself or tidy her mess. Just falling asleep surrounded by candy and cookies. I got undressed, had a shower and a shave, then binned the clothes in the hotel laundry bag. The holdall was now getting pretty full of dirty and blood-stained clothes. I was down to my last change. I got dressed again, tucked the pistol into my waistband, put on my coat, and set the alarm for 5:30. Chapter 20. I was half awake anyway when the alarm went. I'd been tossing and turning all night, and now I couldn't really be asked to get up. People must feel like this when they go to a job they really hate. I finally got myself to my feet, went over to the window and opened the curtains. We were just below eye level with the highway and almost in its shadow. Headlights lumbered silently towards me from out of the gloom. In the other lanes, taillights disappeared back into the darkness like slow-moving tracer. It wasn't time yet. I let the curtain fall and turned down the heating, got the coffee machine gurgling and went into the bathroom. As I took a leak, I looked at myself in a mirror. I looked like a scarecrow, with creases on my face where I'd been lying on some crayons. I took off my jacket, turned in the collar on my polo shirt, and splashed my face in a basin of water. I went back into the bedroom. The brew wasn't ready yet, and my mouth felt as if a gorilla had dumped in it. He'd certainly been in the room while we were both asleep, throwing food and drink cans everywhere. I picked up an already opened can of Mountain Dew and took a couple of flat, warm sips. Until first light, there wasn't that much to do. I was used to this. So much of my life had been hurry up and wait. I pulled up the chair by the window and opened the curtains. Looking at the highway, I couldn't make out whether it was still raining or if it was just vehicle spray in the headlights that made it look that way. By the end of a quarter of an hour, I could begin to make out the shape of the cars as well as their headlights. It was time. There was no need to wake Kelly. The more she slept, the easier my life would be. I checked I had the keycard and moved up to the roof. Rain danced on the metal roof of the lift housing. I pulled myself up and lay there, getting soaked front and back as I pressed the play button on the camera. I checked that I still had the correct sight picture and that the lens hadn't missed it up. It had. I honked at myself because I should have put on another plastic bag to stop the moisture getting in overnight. I started to wipe the moisture off with my cuff and suddenly had the feeling that I was between two worlds. Behind me roared the early morning traffic. Yet in front, towards the river, I could just about hear birds giving it their early morning song. I was almost enjoying it. The moment was soon shattered when the first aircraft of the day took off and disappeared into low cloud. Lens dry, I rechecked the camera position, made sure it was recording and closed the bin liners. It was now nearly 6 a.m. I went back to the room and my chair by the window, coffee in hand. I smiled as I watched a couple come out of the room next door hand in hand. Something about them didn't quite match up. I made a bet with myself that they'd leave in separate cars. For the 100th time, my mind drifted to the telephone call I'd had with Kev. Pat had said that if it was Pyra, there could be a connection with drugs, Gibraltar and the Americans. My hard drive went into freewheel because something about the Gibraltar job had always puzzled me. 1987 had been Pyra's annus horribilis, and, as debt operators in the province, Ewan and I had done our fair share to fuck them over. At the beginning of the year, they'd made a promise to their faithful of tangible success in the War of National Liberation, but it hadn't taken long for that to turn to rat shit. In February, Pyra fielded 27 Sinn Féin candidates in the Irish general election, but they only managed to scrape about 1,000 votes each. Few people in the South gave a toss about reunification.